Hello, friends. This is the Environment Show, and welcome.
The Red Cross takes care of the damage that the Earth does to people and structures. The Green Cross would take care of the damage that people and structures do to the Earth. We've been getting very good at taking the Earth apart, digging into it and scattering its pieces all over the place. It's very easy to break things. It's very hard to put them back together. Some can't be put back together as you lose pieces, but this is a challenge.
The birth control pill came from a tropical yam in Mexico. Treatments for childhood leukemia and Hodgkin disease came from a little flower in the rainforest of Madagascar. Hardwood tables, essential oils and dyes that you'll find in deodorants and toothpaste. The list goes on and on and on.
David Brower, former head of Sierra Club, now proposing a new project. He calls it the Green Cross, and he wants you to join. And Dan Katz, director of the Rainforest Alliance, there are practical reasons why we should save the world's tropical forests, and we'll tell you more. Two of our guests, this time on The Environment Show. The Environment Show is a production of WAMC, made possible by the J.M. Kaplan Fund of New York, and this is Bruce Robertson. David Brower is a name familiar to activists in the environmental movement from his years as head of Sierra Club. Still active nationally and internationally at 78, Brower now leads Earth Island Institute and is as passionate as ever about a new project, for which we'll have an address at the end of this story, prepared by Joy Newell in Los Angeles.
David Brower is a commanding presence, a common-sense voice, an idealist, an activist, and a pro who is used to saying things his audiences will remember. He's on the media circuit these days, talking about the first volume of his autobiography, For Earth's Sake. However, Brower's energies are equally consumed with an idea he has taken from a January speech by Mikhail Gorbachev. The idea is for an international citizens group, which would be devoted to Earth restoration projects. Although its name seemed to change during our conversation when Brower first talked about it, he referred to it as the Green Cross.
The Red Cross takes care of the damage that the Earth does to people and structures. The Green Cross would take care of the damage that people and structures do to the Earth. Even getting very good at taking the Earth apart, digging into it and scattering its pieces all over the place. It's very easy to break things. It's very hard to put them back together. Some can't be put back together as you lose pieces, but this is a challenge.
When Brower makes public appearances, and he does a lot of them, he asks audiences if they're willing to give their time to the service of the planet.
What I'm trying to do is turn that question around. Well, what do you think we ought to do to make this work? But we do want your suggestions. Write them in. Call them in. Because we've got the project. It's an Earth Island Institute project. We've got a few elements of it going now. They're quite different. They're all environmental, but then we've got more to do. We don't need to restore only the outdoors, but we need to do better about the indoors. We need to help the cities. We need to help transportation. We need to rethink education. We need to teach people from the bottom grades on up how to put things back together.
Part of what excites Brower is the idea that people of different ages, races, religions, philosophies, colors, point of view, and so on, would come together for the time they would be dedicating to the Earth Project. Brower, at this point, does not foresee direct government involvement.
Right now, we think that it should be a citizens' movement. And we'd like to go back to the Eisenhower quotation way back. He said one day that the people are going to want peace so much that the governments are going to have to get out of the way and let them have it. And I think that goes with peace on the Earth, but also peace with the Earth. I think citizens groups have got a great mission ahead of them. They have to lead governments. Right now, democracy or not, governments hesitate to do things for which they don't think there's going to be a lot of support.
What are you asking people to give with this concept? Let's call it Green Cross, Green Circle, Green whatever.
Well, we are asking for a year, that they make a commitment for a year. How we're going to engineer that year, we don't know. We're going to want their help. What country would you like to work in? With what kind of people? Do you have some people that you'd like to team up with? What do you want to do? What excites you? You want to take what's driving an individual person and take all that energy and focus it on restoration.
I wanted to know what will move the concept from conversation to reality.
Our questionnaire, when we're working on this, one of my questions, will you need funding or can you fund it? Or do you know people who can fund it? And some people can find their own funds and some people certainly can't. And we would like to make it possible for both kinds to go.
Brower's enthusiasm, energy, and commitment are contagious. And he knows he's sitting on a wave of public and media interest about the environment, but...
The media tire easily, and so we'll have to continue to think up new, exciting news hooks because that's what they live on. And so that's up to us. We've got to be interesting. We've got to get the media themselves excited about it. We've got to get them reporting on it, what's happening, who's done what, where. I want a little, for openers, I want a journal that'll talk about it. I want to call it, let's see, the healing news. The general theme is, that I've used again and again, it's not mine, it's healing time on Earth. Heal the Earth as best you can. Don't be too cocky about it because the Earth has got to heal itself. We can jumpstart some of the healing. It'd be maybe a little like hair transplants, something like that. But we need to get it started, but we also need to heal the relationships with each other.
Brower believes the industrial world must move from destructive to productive industries. To illustrate, he told me about an interview he had done some time ago on the Dick Cavett Show.
And one of the questions Dick Cavett asked me, after he'd jeered Arthur Godfrey in the alligator shoes he was wearing, was, well, a lot of people say that you environmentalists are putting people out of work. What do you say to that? And then he went on and said, I think I can answer that question. I suppose a lot of people were put out of work when they closed the furnaces at Dachau. And his question shook him up so much that he changed the subject. And we're still making furnaces, thousands of nuclear warheads to take to the people. That's a business we ought to get out of. There are better businesses, so let's restore the Earth. It's easy enough to blow it up. Let's see if we can put some things back together.
I hope you're somewhere around paper and pencil, because if you're moved to want to find out more about the Green Cross or the Green Circle or whatever it's going to be called, you can contact David Brower at Earth Island Institute. It's at 300 Broadway, Suite 28, San Francisco, 94133. For the Environment Show in Los Angeles, I'm Joy Newell.
That address, once again, is David Brower, Earth Island Institute, 300 Broadway, Suite 28, San Francisco, California, 94133. Joy Newell reports for the Environment Show from KCRW in Santa Monica. There is a new phrase describing a new concept developing in the world of environmental affairs, new environmentalism, describing the awareness many are coming to that environmental concerns must be balanced with economic needs of a region. Of course, the reverse is also said. Economic needs must take into account environmental concerns. This is necessarily so because often it is the environment that is the mainstay of a region's economy. This is seen most dramatically, perhaps, in the tropical forests of South America. Speaking recently at a natural history conference, noted Harvard biologist Dr. Edward O. Wilson said that the tropical forests cannot long withstand the practice of clear cutting, wherein the forests are cut for their one-time yield of timber, leaving the regions literally lifeless and barren. The problem, Wilson says, is not in the trees, but in the soil. Unlike northern temperate forest soils that are thick and rich with organic material, tropical topsoils are thin and extremely fragile.
In fact, as little as 0.1% of the nutrients in a tropical forest reach 5 centimeters or 2 inches below the actual soil surface. So when all you have to do is take your fingers and scrape a little of the clay off the surface, and you're already into a sterile zone into which very little can grow.
And what is more, says Wilson, the composition of the soil is such that heavy concentrations of minerals quickly wash away in torrential rains, up to 80 inches a year. The soil washout is speeded when plant life is burned off, leaving no root systems in place. Wilson says the regions are then left with virtually worthless soil.
Then farmers move in and try to grow crops there. They may have enough ash and residue to go for 2 or 3 years, and then productivity drops off drastically. The same is true of cattle ranching. So the only choice they have is to keep cutting forests, keep rolling it back, like a carpet off a bare floor, to exploit it mile by mile. And in the end, they have nothing left.
Biologist Dr. Edward Wilson speaking at a scientific conference convened recently at the New York State Museum in Albany. While the harvesting of the trees in the tropical forests might bring in a substantial amount of income on a one-time basis, once the lumber is gone, that is it. Much more logical, says Dan Katz, is a policy of sustainable harvest.
Selective cutting or using the forest for economic gain without destroying the ecosystem's integrity. That is, using it, benefiting from it, but at the same time leaving it in a way that is not damaging it in a negative way.
Katz is the executive director of the Rainforest Alliance. Founded in 1986, the organization began as a way to focus attention on the rainforest. He says that as awareness has grown, so has the focus of his organization's operations. Now the alliance concentrates on looking for a viable alternative to deforestation. Katz says the controversy over how to provide for a healthy economy locally and at the same time preserve and protect the rainforest for a global environment is best settled on a local level. The Rainforest Alliance, he says, is working closely with rural towns, villages, and outposts to help the local residents there develop economically viable alternative ways to provide for their future. It is a challenge of the first order, says Katz, who offers this overview of the issues.
The rainforest is like this counterfeit paradise. It looks beautiful and green, a thousand shades of green, and over half the world's living species can be found there. And yet, when you try and farm it, it reacts very poorly. It does not like monocrops. It likes to be very diverse, and it has a very fragile soil that's been leached for thousands of years. So it's tough to use. And the people that have been living there for a long time know how to use it, and they know how to use it well, and we need to learn from them. And because of economic stagnation, population problems, military issues, peoples are being forced out of the cities and transmigrated into the jungles. And these people see this as this paradise, and yet when they try and eke out a living, they do not fare very well. And I think that when we look to solving the problems in the tropics, we also need to look at helping to solve the problems in the major cities, because if we cannot do that, then there will always be this influx of displaced urban poor into the jungles.
And in the true Buckminster Fuller style, this being a global village, the problems and the solutions reach far beyond, in this case, the Brazilian rainforest.
We in the United States account for so much of the world's resources. We use a proportion that is just unheard of for the rest of the world. So I think we're going to need to be better conservationists here at home. It's not going to be enough for us to just send in a check for $20 and feel like we've done our job for the rainforest. We're going to need to conserve more, be better consumers, eat lower on the food chain. You know, there's a lot of things that we're going to have to do. I think that Earth Day sprung a lot of new interest, and I'm amazed at how many more people are talking about recycling or buying recycled products or looking at over-packaging. These are issues that are not just going to be trendy for this year. They are the wave of the future, and we need more businesses to jump on this bandwagon and stay on it for the long haul, because really, if we expect to conserve forests in the tropics, we will need to do a much better job here at home.
Dan Katz, executive director of the Rainforest Alliance. Anthropologist Stephen Schwartzman with the Environmental Defense Fund first came to the problem in 1980 when he went to Brazil to study the Kranakorti Indians. The destruction of this tribe is the story of the destruction of the rainforest.
Kranakorti are people who, between 1968 and 1973, when they were first contacted by the National Society, lost between 80 and 90% of their population to new diseases to which they had no resistance. They passed through a holocaust. They were then transferred from their traditional lands to the Xingu Park, which was already an established reserve where their lands were somewhat better protected. And on their own initiative, they set about trying to reconstitute their traditional society in very different circumstances. So my first connection was to the human rights disaster that was going on, which is part of the same story that's occurred in the Americas since 1492, of course. But I came to see very clearly that this was also an environmental story.
Schwartzman says that the Indians are living on this reserve with the frontier closing in very rapidly all around them. Loss of this wilderness habitat is threatening the very existence of the Indians who live off this land, but Schwartzman says there are two reasons why we all have a stake in what is happening.
First of all, tropical forests occupy about 7% of the Earth's surface, but they contain between 50 and 90% of the species of living things on the planet. They are the greatest repository of biological genetic diversity anywhere. Biologists who study this from a biological standpoint say that the species extinction that is going on there, perhaps one species a day disappearing, is the greatest extinction that's gone on in the history of the planet. No one can tell what the consequences of that are liable to be.
The other reason, says Schwartzman, is more immediate. The rainforests play a very important role in both local and global climates.
Locally, half of the rainfall that falls over the Amazon basin, for example, is produced by the forest itself. There's excellent work by Brazilian scientists showing this, such that deforesting large areas of the Amazon is going to cause rainfall patterns to change, and as other recent work has shown, it's liable to cause local temperature patterns to change quite drastically. And beyond that, cutting and burning the forest releases large quantities of greenhouse gases into the atmosphere, CO2 and others, and is contributing to global warming.
According to a recent report released by World Resources Institute, the world is losing its tropical forests at a much faster rate than had previously been thought. In fact, 50% faster. Statistically, though the rate of loss has actually slowed in Brazil from that observed 10 years ago, the nation still leads the world in the rate and the amount of lost tropical rainforests per year. There are both internal and external reasons why this is so, says Schwartzman, who has recently returned from a research tour to Brazil. The internal reasons are complex but have to do with land ownership. Since 1964, there has been a concerted effort by the government to open up the rainforest for settlement, and the easiest way to show ownership of land is to show a profit from it. And the quickest way to do that is to clear the land and throw in some crops or cattle, never mind that the land cannot sustain these products. The other reasons for this rainforest loss lie abroad.
If you look at the satellite data of deforestation in the Amazon, it's a very uneven process. There are very large areas where virtually no deforestation is occurring. There are other areas where deforestation is occurring very rapidly indeed, and those are precisely where large-scale infrastructure projects have taken place, roads, railroads, mining projects, and so on.
These projects, Schwartzman says, have been funded in large part by the World Bank, which in turn receives its largest contribution from the United States. This process of U.S. participation in multilateral funding of development projects has been brought to the attention of the U.S. Congress, the U.S. Treasury Department, and organizations such as the World Bank in an effort to make the connection between these projects and environmental destruction. In 1987, the World Bank initiated a process of reform, setting up an environment department to monitor its projects. Results have been mixed. These are surely delicate issues at play here, not the least of which is that Brazil must choose for itself how best to proceed, and far be it for us to tell the rest of the world how to preserve natural resources when we destroy much of our own. In any case, whether in Brazil or the United States, the balance in this so-called new environmentalism is to develop a sustainable economy, take only what the land can give, and put back no more than the land can tolerate. This, it is argued, makes not only good environmental sense, but stands up economically as well. In fact, results of a recent study undertaken by the Institute of Economic Botany show that the rainforest is much more productive alive than dead. Mike Balick, the Institute's director, says that the research was conducted by one of the associates at the Institute, Dr. Charles Peters, in conjunction with colleagues from the Missouri Botanical Garden and the Yale School of Forestry. Peters, who is off currently in Indonesia researching a similar situation, could not be reached for analysis of this study, but Director Balick says that Peters compared the yield of 2.5 acres of lot in rainforest, looking at the value of the lumber that could be harvested in a one-time deal, comparing that with the value of the total extractable renewable resources, that is, fruit, fibers, resins, or oils.
And what they found was very interesting, that cutting down the forest for one-time use could bring around $1,000 U.S. And the scenario after this one-time use would be burning the forest, perhaps growing crops on it for a year or two and then abandoning it, with it so that this use would be very short-term. In contrast, they found that the value of a hectare of forest for the harvest of fruits, barks, oils, fibers, so-called minor forest products, was almost $700 U.S. each year. And because these products are harvested in a sustainable way, this return, that is to say almost $700, could be harvested almost indefinitely.
It should be pointed out that Dr. Peters, along with Dr. Alan Gentry from the Missouri Botanical Garden and Professor Robert Mendelson from Yale School of Forestry, conducted their research in the Peruvian rainforest. Though the names have been changed in this instance, the implications are the same. Again, Mike Balick.
Certainly, an important point is that while people's consciousness has been raised about the value of the rainforest and its importance and the importance of stopping deforestation, very few groups, very few agencies are offering alternatives to this deforestation that take into account the local people's need to exist and survive and meet a standard of living that is appropriate. And these alternatives to deforestation, although some of them are, these studies are in their embryonic stages, this is a key aspect of solving this particular global dilemma.
He says that most of the work conducted by his research group is concentrated in the world's tropical forests because that is where the greatest diversity of plant and animal life is found and where the greatest crises are found, crises of plant, animal, and human population threatening each other's existences. The Institute of Economic Botany is associated with the New York Botanical Garden in the Bronx. As Dan Katz of the Rainforest Alliance says, it is time to start putting something back into the forest. Investment dollars, and research. It is impossible, he says, to do a day, a half a day, or even a single meal without using something that derives from the tropical forests.
Well, everything from oranges and bananas and peanuts and tomatoes to the birth control pill came from a tropical yam in Mexico. Treatments for childhood leukemia and Hodgkin disease came from a little flower in the rainforest of Madagascar. Hardwood tables, essential oils and dyes that you'll find in deodorants and toothpaste. The list goes on and on and on. It is just incredible how much we have derived from tropical forests and how little we have given back to the countries where those products came from or to the conservation of those areas.
Observers of international politics and economics are studying with keen interest the recently announced Bush administration plan to develop a free trade agreement with Latin and South America, similar to the one now in place with Canada. And one can only wonder whether now is the time when world leaders can bring it all together: peaceful political revolution, jobs and homes for the homeless and impoverished, and preservation of the delicate and only ecosystem by which all of this is sustained. For the Environment Show, this is Bruce Robertson. As we learn more and more about Brazil's tropical forests, we are becoming equally aware of how fragile and easily destroyed that region is, despite its size and rather forbidding nature. Cutting trees, growing vegetables and grains, or raising cattle, it is becoming clear, is not the proper or sustainable long-term use of the region. But there is a way of managing the forests that will leave the natural ecosystem intact, help the local economy, and give us something tasty to eat. The Vermont-based ice cream firm of Ben & Jerry's has begun marketing an ice cream called Rainforest Crunch, using their own ice cream and a Brazil nut brittle, which is now marketed by Martha Broad, co-manager of Community Products Incorporated.
Rainforest Crunch is a butter crunch candy, and we started making it back in August, and we're making now about a ton of candy a day. We started up in an old auto body repair shop in Montpelier, and we started out with 3 people last August, and now we're about 30 people. And from August until March of this year, we primarily sold 8-ounce boxes of candy to gourmet food stores and all sorts of different stores, mail order catalogs. And then in March, Ben and Jerry's started buying large amounts of Rainforest Crunch from us to put in vanilla ice cream, and they now are marketing a new flavor of ice cream, which is very popular, called Rainforest Crunch Ice Cream.
The idea started with Jason Clay, head of Cultural Survival. Clay reportedly met Ben Cohen of Ben and Jerry's at a New York City Grateful Dead Rainforest Benefit concert. Clay said he was sitting on a stash of Brazil nuts, and what can we do? Clay and Cohen, who had been thinking he'd like to try a new flavor, spent one Sunday afternoon together concocting the new recipe, so the story has it. Broad says her goal is twofold: produce a good product and pass along money to the Brazilian economy. She says her corporation, a branch of Ben & Jerry's, turns 60% of its profits back to peace and environmental groups. Ben & Jerry's, a much larger firm, donates 7.5% of its profits.
What we do every day we use and buy nuts is we pass on more money to the nut harvesters. Where money that we are paying for nuts, part of that goes to Cultural Survival. We buy nuts through them, and we pay them a little bit extra, and that money goes to setting up nut harvesting and shelling facilities that are cooperatively owned by the people down in the rainforest.
Right now, the nuts are harvested cheaply in the rainforest, but then sent downriver where all the profits are realized during processing. But, says Broad,
the idea is for the people that are actually harvesting and shelling nuts to be adding value by being able to process the nuts right in the rainforest and then sell them for a higher price and get more money for them. What happens now is that they harvest the nuts and they get shipped downriver to a port city, at which point, you know, a larger private concern buys them for very little money and, you know, processes and vacuum packs the nuts.
Rainforest Crunch candy is available in many specialty stores and major department stores. Martha Broad, co-manager of Community Products Incorporated, tells us she is working on a Rainforest Crunch cookie. For The Environment Show, this is Bruce Robertson. And that's our show for this week. The Environment Show is a production of WAMC. Dr. Alan Shartok, executive producer. This is Bruce Robertson. The Environment Show is made possible by the J.M. Kaplan Fund of New York.